Hey, Podnutskins. Welcome to the Mini PC Show, episode 95. I'm Door-to-Door Geek, owner-operator of Podnuts. I believe that Brian has to work tonight. Rich is doing the Linux Link Tech Show, and if he feels up to it, he'll be in the show as of right now. He said he doesn't feel great, but he might have a chance to stop in. My audio sounds not perfect. Give me one second. Testing. Okay, no, it's fine. So I'll have to try to remember to edit that out. Okay, this episode of the Mini PC Show is brought to you by Jill and Steve, aka Jill Linux Girl. Thank you very much for the support, Jill. Thank you very much for all the Patreon supporters. Thank you very much for Chatter and for Red for coming out tonight. Even though Red's at work, he still finds time to drop in. So I definitely want to say thank you for that. I want to say again, thanks for everyone for the Patreon support. And I want to say thanks for everyone who was able to go to the Eric Ardini link and help support his family through the GoFundMe campaign. That definitely helped a lot. It's over $11,000, and every little bit's going to help the family. I don't want to say move on, but carry on in life without Eric there to help them out. We haven't had a lot of news in the realm of mini PC stuff. We have not had a lot of activity, I'll say, on our personal communication mechanism between me, Rich, and Brian. I will say, I'll do like the straggling personal kind of news with the mini PC stuff. And the first thing that was good friend Josh from Canada was talking to me, and he noticed that Orange Pi was dropped out of support on Diet Pi. Diet Pi is one of those alternate quote unquote operating systems that we are really big fans of. And part of the reason we're really big fans of it is just for its simplicity. They have gotten a lot better with security since they first dropped on the scene. For a while there, Armbian was doing much better at security than they were, is what I'll say. But in recent years, they've definitely tightened up their ecosystem to be much more friendlier to being more secure without a lot of work. Let me make sure I tried to bookmark that Diet Pi link. Okay. And here's what I remembered, forgot, and then remembered again. It almost does not matter if Diet Pi directly supports your board, whether it be ARM-based, whether it be MIPS-based, whatever. Okay. Let's just say right now, it doesn't matter. Okay. Here's the reason why. If you go to the Diet Pi homepage, dietpi.com, you click on download, you can see there's a Allo Asus Nano Odroid Pine Raspberry Pi PC/VM, and then there's other. If you click on other, it basically says other device. If you click there, it basically sends you to a install guide to where you can basically convert any Debian or Raspbian based operating system into a Diet Pi operating system. Now, it's not going to be the exact same as having an actual Diet Pi installation, but it will get you remarkably close, is what I will say. So even if you have an Orange Pi, even if Diet Pi does not officially support your board anymore, you can technically still go get a version of Raspbian, get a version of Debian, get a version of Armbian, get whatever, any of those spins of Debian. And then you can go through this install script where it's basically just an SH file. You download, you run it, and then it converts your system into a much, much, much more Diet Pi-like system. So there is hope, even if it doesn't directly support your board anymore. You know, all hope is not lost, is what I'll say. The other little bit of side news was Pi-hole. Okay, I decided to give Pi-hole a spin, and it's partially because the ad stuff has really gotten, in my opinion, near the peak of worst that it's ever been, even with Punch the Monkey and, you know, the Flash ads in the past. They're just everywhere, everywhere I go, every page I look at, everywhere. So I said, well, you know, how about we go ahead and get some Diet Pi going with some Pi-hole. So what I did was I have a Raspberry Pi 3 with, to me, Diet Pi and Pi-hole, you don't need a remarkably fast system. DNS is not the most intensive thing you can do on your network. So it really doesn't take a lot of bits up on your network, and it doesn't take a lot of processing power as well. So I did download DietPy. I did load it on my Raspberry Pi. I did load Pi-hole. And I'll say in the beginning, the default, I was not seeing what I consider to be very good blocking, because I would go to web pages and I still saw what I considered to be just as many ads. I'll say this, of course, it was not as many ads, but it sure seemed like as many ads. So then what I was ba basically did was I went and I did a search on Google for ad block tester. So I was able to go to pages and check how good that the ad blocking was, and it wasn't really doing a lot of jobs. It was only blocking something like 20% of ads. So there will be a link in the show notes to what I found was it's just like back in the old days, I'll say, you can set up extra what's called blacklist. And all it really is, it's another URL that you can add in the DietPy configuration. It's all in a GUI where you basically just go and you copy web links into your configuration to add it as being another block list. So I did that a couple of times. I added at least two or three more. I'm going to try to remember to put them in the notes as well. And now I'm seeing upwards of 40 to 50 something percent of content being blocked on my network. But it's not on my whole network. I did not put it in my router. I did not, make it go through my whole network because here's the thing. I don't have it even hardwired up to my network, which worries me just a touch. I have my Raspberry Pi sitting here on a battery backup, but it's literally wireless into my network. So my logic is I'm going to run it on what is right now my streaming computer, run it on there for at least 2 weeks, see how comfortable I am with it. Once I feel comfortable with it, then I will probably just add it as a physical networkable address, not wireless. Just won't have to worry about anything happening to it. But I'm feeling better about my browsing experience with putting Pi-hole on my network and adding these extra block list addresses to my configuration. The default was not really doing much for me. I did try the Brave browser. I've heard more than a couple of people try to tout how Brave browser does good. And there's another browser out there that was getting some traction a couple of weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago. None of the browsers I tried did anything about ads as far as I could tell that I was comfortable with. They all just sucked. The only browser, to be honest, I've ever found that does good with ad blocking is literally something like Lynx, which is a command line text only browser. And that's not really usable. So once I feel good about this, I'm going to convert my Pi-hole to a physical installation. But here's the other gimmick. I have a laptop where I take it around and I take it like to work, but I can't carry around an ARM computer with me and connect it to my laptop and then have that as my Pi hole. So here's what I'm going to try to do. There is a PC VM link on DietPy. So the logic is I can download the VirtualBox version of it, and I can load it either in KVM, GNOME boxes, or VirtualBox, and have it as a virtual machine on my computer. And install Pi-hole there, and then have my DNS point to that. That's what my logic is. That should work, and it should be completely portable. I can take my laptop anywhere, and as long as I'm connecting through like my phone or something, I can easily have the network configured so I can have a mobile Pi-hole on the go. So I'm really tempted to try that as well, just because when I'm at work, I'm tethered to my phone, which means I'm already getting limited bandwidth, limited speed. If I use too much bandwidth, my speed's even more limited. So the logic is then if I could limit the amount of stuff coming down that data connection in the sense of ads, I should be able to have a better experience and have the same amount of time on my computer and use less data so I can technically do things a little bit longer and not have to worry about getting slowed down even quicker. The Pinebook Pro is officially on sale. It literally went on sale after we missed the last show. So it's been about a week now. It's like 6 days now that it's been up available for purchase. Again, $200 laptop. I'm convinced it is a fair price. It's not a great price. It's a very fair price. We'll go over some of the specs again, just to make sure everyone knows what they are. You get a 64-bit dual core. It's actually a quad core, six core, little big core. RK 3399 processor, which is pretty good. A quad core graphical chip on it as well. 4 gigs of RAM, 64 gigs of flash by default. You can upgrade to 128. Wi-Fi 11 AC, Bluetooth 5, one USB 3.0 and one USB 2.0. You also get the Type-C port, which also you can use as power. So you can power up the device through that, which I like a lot. It has a micro SD card slot, a headphone jack, a microphone built in, a full-size keyboard, a large multi-touch trackpad. Both the keyboard and trackpad look much better than what I had in the old Pinebook. Power input, 100 to 240 volts, output 5 volt, 3 amps. The battery's 10,000 milliamp. I would expect that really should get between 4 and 6 hours battery. If it gets more than 6 hours battery, I'm going to be pretty impressed. Watching a video, I wouldn't expect it to be more than like 3 hours. But we don't know yet, is what I'll say. Display is 14.1 IPS, 1920 by 1080. The front camera, power supply included. Weighs 2.78 pounds. Warranty is only for 30 days. This is almost like a beta device. So don't expect a perfect device to come off the line in the very beginning. There is also a video that we will have in the notes where the one of the lead developers is basically showing off the Pinebook Pro. This was a couple days right before it went live. And they do things like showing you dual monitor support, Quake 3 demo, YouTube demo, stuff like that. And it looks, to be honest, very fair demo of it. It looks to me like a really solid running device. There are in bold red notes when you go to the buy page where it says note, the Pinebook Pro will use pre-order method and inform by email. Due to the lithium battery in the Pinebook Pro, shipments of Pinebook Pro orders will be handled differently from other Pine 64 products because of the size of the battery. That's just the way the laws are. A small number of 1 to 3 stuck dead pixels are characteristics of this LCD screen. These are normal and should not be considered a defect. When fulfilling the purchase, please bear in mind that we are offering the Pinebook Pro at this price as a community service to Pine 64, Linux, and BSD communities. We make no profit from selling these units. If you think that a minor dissatisfaction such as a dead pixel will prompt you to file a PayPal dispute, then please do not purchase the Pinebook Pro. Thank you. I'll say that. That's a very honest way of them telling you, you know, the quality control on these laptop screens are not insanely high because basically we couldn't afford it. We want to keep the price down. Yeah, and they're not making any money off of it. I honestly believe they're not. I believe they're barely making enough to cover the price of the product, the storage, the shipment, and the people to actually do the processing of getting these things shipped out. It wouldn't shock me if they're making literally like a penny off of each Pinebook Pro. So if you're finicky, if you're picky, don't buy it. If you want to support a company trying to support communities and Linux and BSDs and distributions, you know, and Floss and, you know, open software, then buy it. I will say right now, I can't afford it. I would love to be able to afford it. I can't afford it. So hopefully by November-ish, I'll be able to swing it and buy one. Rich, I believe, just flat out does not have the money right now. He, like me, has normal life kind of things going on. Brian's working right now, so you know he's not swimming in money either. But also, Brian registered in the forums what everything said was early enough to be to have the free upgrade to 120 gig internal SSD available to him. He got no notification for it, and he said, you know, I joined in time. This is the reason I joined. I wanted to get the bigger drive. They didn't offer him the bigger drives right now. He's not buying it either. I will say, I don't know how many shows you guys listen to that are not completely inundated with ads, okay? Where you have three hosts that are at least excited about a launching of a new piece of hardware and it's officially launched for pre-order, and none of us are jumping on it basically because we can't afford it, or, you know, we didn't get the offer that we were kind of promised kind of thing. I'm still very positive about it. It's just I can't afford it right now. I really do like the look of it. The demo, I will say again, was one of the developers. Let me see if I can pull that up without having audio come through the stream. Close. Okay, yeah. Yeah, this is actually posted on the official Pine 64 channel, which is definitely a plus. Yeah, I'll say this. The device looks much more polished, much more of a quality rather than like a normal cheap Chromebook. Looks a little bit better quality than that. Definitely looks like a better quality than like a netbook. He does say running 4K video on the device itself. I believe it was 4K video, 60 frames a second would not play. Basically, it didn't look good. Drop it down to 30, it looked perfectly fine. When outputting to a high-end monitor, he was able to get 4K 60 frames a second with basically no issue. That to me is unbelievably good. The dual display, it's very configurable where you can have it mirror or extend the desktop. That honestly looked really cool. I like the idea of that. I don't know if I would ever use it, but I definitely like the idea of it. Then at the very end of the video, he played some Quake on it, and I'll say this, I'm not good at the video games, but it definitely looked to me like it was running pretty smooth, pretty good, pretty clean. So yeah, I will look forward to trying to buy this sooner or later, and I cannot wait to hear normal people post about their experiences with it to see if it is, meeting expectations is what I want to say. I'll also say I do not have my Raspberry Pi 4 yet either. I already got an email from the company I bought it from, which I can't remember off the top of my head, asking me to fill out a survey on my experience with the device, like a review. And I never got a shipping notification. I never got any tracking notification. I honestly don't think they've shipped it yet. So I'm waiting on my Raspberry Pi because I do not need any more Raspberry Pis with a 1 gig or 2 gig. I want the most gigs that are available. And I will say the people out there who are saying you don't need the 4 gig version, you can't say that. That's like saying you'll never need more than 64K of RAM. And if you're old, you've heard that one before too. It depends. It's like anything else in life. There is no one simple straight answer. It depends. If you're going to do some sort of graphically intensive task whatsoever, you really should get the 4 gig version and then allocate more of that default RAM to the video, and then you have even more available for normal tasks. But if you're only going to do server-based, headless-based kind of things, the 1 gig one is probably, I'll say that's perfectly fine. Hey, Rich.
Hey buddy, how are you?
I'm doing fairly well. How about yourself?
You're not streaming on the YouTubes.
Oh, crikey. Well, it helps when I hit go live. I was so worried about the other ones. I actually have been recording locally at least for 20 minutes. So then let's hit go live. And I do have it locally recorded video. So when I'm done, I will upload the completed video for it, and I'll delete this stream when I'm done. Sorry about that, guys. Basically just talked a little bit about the my Diet Pi experience, having to add more files to like the block list, more URLs to the block list, and all it is,
Pie hole, you mean?
I'm sorry,
Pie hole?
yeah, to the Pi hole. And all it really is it's a URL of a text file, and in the text file is a listing of servers that are basically blacklisted, so you can't connect. And I added at least two or three to mine. When I did that, I'm getting above 40% of my things being blocked, which I think is pretty
Now,
good.
I kind of set up my pie hole and threw it over the wall and ran out of the house. So probably about an hour before I left to go to Orlando for the week, I set up the pie hole, changed the DNS. I set my pie hole as the primary DNS, and I set Google as my secondary DNS. So if the pie hole goes down, we'll still have DNS in the house. So I really didn't do a deep dive on testing it, but it looked pretty good. And since I'm on a metered connection, I get a terabyte a month. If I cut down the bandwidth from the ads, all the better.
Yeah, there's I'll say this, there's different numbers I've heard with all the security stuff that I listen to now. Like on mobile connections, it's literally at some cases almost 40% of your traffic is from trackers and from ad type material. I've heard home networks sometimes as low as 30, sometimes literally almost 50% of your data. You go to a web page, sometimes the total amount of content being downloaded is like 20 megs, and no web page uses 20 megs.
If you read news online, I would say it's 10% content, 90% ad. It's 90% crap you don't want to have anything to do with. And I don't, I'm not trying. Here's the whole thing. Dor, you really got me thinking of the right way on this. If there's something you like, and whether it's a open source product online or whatever it may be, whether it's a news site that you read, there needs to be a way for them to make money at it. So if you like, you know, whatever product, let's just say Diet Pie. Say if you like Diet Pie, you know what? You need to kick them a couple of bucks. You need to be a Patreon or however they raise money. And I give them a lot of lip service. I haven't done it, so I ought to, like, put that on my list. But likewise, the new sites, I don't have a problem if they put some ads. Now, if they put the ads to the left or to the right, as opposed to in between the frickin' paragraph with the same font and the same color and the same everything, yeah. So I don't know whether I'm reading ad or the news story. And I hate to say it, if they did absolutely reasonable, and reasonable according to me, if they were reasonable about how they did their ads on their site, I wouldn't do a blocker.
Well, and on mobile, to me, it seems especially scummy because sometimes the ad is like an embedded scrollable object where, scroll, it's like a full page all of a sudden until you keep scrolling. It's gotten really bad, but I will say this. I did say on the recording, at least, I do not have my Pi hole connected to my router. Okay. And here's the real reason why. I have it running on a Raspberry Pi 3. Running off a battery backup, but it's wireless. So right now, literally, it's only the streaming computer that is that has its DNS configured for it. So that's it. The logic is, as soon as I loaded it up, booted it up, it was literally only blocking around 14% of the stuff I was accessing, which is ridiculous because every page I went to looked exactly the same with ads. I saw no obvious decrease in ads until I added the extra blacklist URLs, and now again it's up to like 40-ish%, so I feel much better. But I also take a laptop with me, so I'm also going to consider looking at running Pi Hole in a Diet Pi VM on my laptop and have it like a local server, so I can basically go anywhere, you know, and have my Pi Hole.
I was kind of thinking about that also. As I am here in the Orlando command, I do not have that available. Now, I'm not on a metered connection here in Orlando. But yeah, I was like, I kind of like not having the ads, and maybe it's worth having some, you know, universal solution that I can take along with me.
Well, I guarantee you, here's the whole, I think, real truth of it. If you have it properly configured, it doesn't matter what your limits are. It doesn't matter what your speed is. It doesn't matter what your personal laptop processor is. It doesn't matter what your drive IO is or anything else. You will see a visible improvement just because you're literally having to process half the amount of data coming down the pipe. So there should be a visible speed improvement.
And that's the thing. I've talked many times about that I have netbooks. Oh, and I used the netbook for something cool recently. Even though the netbook is fully 100% functional, I can't even browse a web page with it because you need a freaking supercomputer to do that. But I used a netbook to run a Ghost Gunner recently.
I have no idea what that is.
Basically, it mills out 80% AR-15 lowers.
Gotcha. Very cool. And I also went over a little bit about the Pinebook Pro and how basically, you know, we all three are literally excited for the product to become real and to be out in the real world. But right now, I can't afford it. I don't think you can afford it. And Brian right now just isn't pulling the trigger because he did not get the offer for the free 128 gig internal upgrade.
Oh, that's in, you know, boy, if you saw my finances, you'd be, dude, you shouldn't, I should be driving $1,000 car. I definitely want to get one. It's definitely on my list. Do I need it? Absolutely not.
Well, and part of getting it is literally just to support Pine.
Oh, yeah.
Did you read the red text on the official Pinebook Pro pre-order page? Which is a lot of alliteration. Oh, my Lord.
Just because I haven't had the ducats.
Well, it basically says on there, when you buy this, you're buying it to support Pine. You're buying this to support BSD. You're buying this to support Linux. You're buying this to support the community. we're not making a penny off of it, which,
oh,
which
wow.
honestly, it wouldn't shock me if they're making, you know, nothing off of it, like scrapes.
$200, it's tough to make any money on that.
Yeah, and, but in the description, it has in red text, if you are the kind of person who will file a PayPal rebute on the money because of a dead pixel on a screen, then don't buy this product, because we are expecting anywhere from 1 to 3 dead pixels on a screen. So to me, I'll say a big kudos for them for being upfront and honest about that.
Yep.
Because they could just try to ignore it and hope people don't notice, kind of thing. And I'll say this, I'm the kind of person, I would buy it. It could have probably like 6 pixels, dead pixels, or 10 dead pixels. I'm not even sure I would notice. And even if I did, I would think, well, it was only $200.
$200, I'd be pretty damn happy.
Yeah. So then, and I also mentioned how I still have not gotten my Raspberry Pi 4, but you did get yours. And it looks like you're muted and deafened. Okay. I'll say this, another link in the notes that Rich put there, and it was something that I swear I knew about, but then I completely forgot about again. In Raspberry Pi-based distributions and Diet Pi, you can drop to a command line, and like in Diet Pi, you can basically just run Diet Pi launcher, and in ARM and in Raspbian, you can type a Raspberry config. Well, Rich reminded me of Armbian-config is available in Armbian-based distributions, which is like, I'll say, a Diet Pi light-like interface.
Yeah. So did you watch my video on the Raspberry Pi 4?
No.
Wow, you said no too fast. You know, you could have, like, eased into that a little.
I, if given the chance right now, I would shut down all of YouTube. That's how much I watch YouTube. I can't stand the company. I can't stand the lack of morals. I can't stand the lack of ethics. I can't stand the dire desperation of monetization by a huge percentage of the people on there, and how everyone seems to be very okay with it. I don't watch really anything on YouTube if I can help it.
Wow. All right. Yeah, I do consume a lot of YouTube. But the short of it is I did thermal testing like the guy from Explaining Computers, and I found in 7 cycles of computing prime numbers up to 250,000 without any fans or heat sinks, it hit thermal throttling in 7 cycles.
Wow.
If I put heat sinks on it in a 40-millimeter fan, and that's a heatsink on the CPU, one on the USB controller, and one on the Ethernet controller, it never got above 59 degrees C. 80 degrees C is where you have thermal throttling, and so I was pretty happy with that.
Yeah.
So that's short of it. Oh, and the heatsinks, I bought a 3-pack for $7. You can buy the single pack, which is $5. So for $2, I figure it's worth having more. And the fan was $5, but I didn't like the amount of noise I got off the 40-millimeter fan. So for like a buck and change, and like a little less than $2 for shipping from AliExpress, I got a silent 80-millimeter 5-volt fan coming. Actually, I bought a couple of
80-millimeter. I want to see that in comparison to the Pi when you get it. And now here's also the question: I do believe you still have to manually run the I believe it's a script file to update
the firmware
for the USB host controller to, so it doesn't get hot.
So I didn't even do that, and I don't know when it, I'm assuming temperature is for the CPU and not the USB. I don't know if that heats it up on the board. I find that a little hard to believe because of the distance between them. Yeah, I didn't run that firmware.
Gotcha. Yeah, I do believe that its heat can contribute to the processor heat, but it's not going to be like a major contributing factor to it, just mm-hmm. a contributing factor. And I'll say this, if what you have, you consider it to be like, you know, I don't want to say a superb fan and just normal heat sinks, and you're getting that temperature, to me, that's phenomenal. I am now past the point of needing all my mini computers to be perfectly quiet. So I'm going to be okay with the fan, but like you, when I get mine, I am going to make sure that whatever fan is on it is at least more quiet than not. And if I'm not mistaken, everyone tells me bigger fans quieter. So if you were not happy with a 40 millimeter fan, I have to imagine a 30 millimeter fan would have not given you as good results, and you wouldn't been happy with the noise.
Yeah, yeah. So in my, I don't have the data center in a drawer anymore. I have, you know, the data center in a cabinet now. And I have a 100 millimeter fan hanging from the ceiling of like where the shelf is over some of my Pi devices. So it's like the Odroid XU4 and a couple other things. And just kind of just keep the air moving, because all of the power supplies are on the shelf below. I just want to make sure there's some air moving. And I took the fans off the Pi 4. I just kind of have it, you know, baking in running Pi hole, so it's not getting taxed. I threw it in there without a fan on it, but there is air moving around it, so that's good. But again, Pi hole you could run on a Pi 0. You don't need a Pi 4 with 4 gigs of RAM to do that. So I'm not concerned about, even if I didn't have heat sinks or a fan running Pi hole, that it would get to thermal overload.
Yeah, I'll say to me, that's one of the good things about Pi hole is you really don't have to stress about even what kind of device it's on. It is not processor intensive. It's not network intensive. It's not IO intensive. And with all that said, it's still ridiculously useful, I think, functional when properly configured.
Well, the other cool thing about Pi hole is some, like I have Vizio TVs and the Vizio smart TVs, and they phone home, and there's a list. So if you look at Pi hole and Vizio TV, if you Google that, you can find a list of URLs that you can block so it doesn't phone home.
Gotcha. Yeah. I mean, me, honestly, I'm almost to the point where I'm literally going to set up a second network that's nothing more than everything I hate to be on it.
Right. Right. And that's so my bandwidth, my terabyte a month that I'm allowed from Comcast is computed both on upload and download. So if crap's phoning home on a regular basis, I found one of the things that was chewing up a lot of bandwidth was every 30 minutes I was doing a speed test. I stopped doing the speed test because I was using so much data.
Yeah, if it's counting both ways, that's to me scary. And I'll say this. One of the concerns I have with the Raspberry Pi 4 is to put a case on it. I'll say this. Like the Rock Pro 64 and other, and like Orange Pi devices and Nano PC kind of devices, I'm basically okay with never putting a case on them just to make sure that the heat can get out anywhere it wants to get out. Like you're having the fan in the drawer, just movement of air around these things is a help, really measurable, good help. So I'm almost hesitant about putting cases on things, but if you're taking a look at the notes, Rich, it's line 993. Yeah, 993 in the notes. It's a Thingiverse link, which I'll say, I don't know about you, but unfortunately, half the time I click on a Thingiverse link, it takes anywhere from a minute to like 3 minutes for everything to fully load. But to me, it's definitely one of the better cases I've seen for these mini computers. And this one was given to me by Captain Zero. Thank you very much, Captain Zero. It's called a Raspberry Pi 4 GPIO/Octoprint ready case, includes slim top and Visa mount and a hole on the top for a big fan is what I'm going to say. Plenty of,
oh wow,
yeah, I mean plenty of airflow holes everywhere around it. Different tops and different bottoms to it depending on how you're going to use it, including, yeah, like they said, the Visa mount. Different size holes on the top, so depending on what size fan you have, right there, you know, ready to connect everything onto it. So this one I'm going to download. I'm not going to print yet because I'm not sure what I'm going to do when I get to Pi 4, how it's going to be handled. But this to me looks like maybe one of the more premier looking Raspberry Pi 4 cases that I've seen that I can print myself.
All right, so I like the case. Here's the problem. The volume of airflow in as far as vents, and this works for electricity also. You know, if you got powers and grounds, your power and ground wire need to be the same size. Same thing If you have an 80 millimeter diameter opening on the top of your case, you've got to have that volume of that 80 millimeter for an exit. Otherwise, you're restricting the airflow.
On all these cases, you should never have the fan blowing in, ever. You should always have the fan sucking air out, number one, because you don't want to push air in, you want to pull air out, is my logic.
But either way, same thing.
Well, all I know is having the holes like this on the side and on the back side is better than none at all, because I've seen at least two or three cases now where they intend you to buy like $20 plus Raspberry Pi cases, where I'm seeing virtually no ventilation at all, or literally no ventilation, and they're aluminum cases. So I don't understand who thinks that's a good idea. I'm not saying this is perfect, Rich, but what I'm saying, among the printable designs, this is in the top two that I've seen. But I like the different configurations that this has, which is the real reason why I tagged it.
Yeah, I would definitely mod this and add more ventilation. But also, this violates your prime directive door.
Don't trust anyone?
Almost.
If you don't have root, you don't know who does?
No, there's no pictures of an actual print.
Yeah, I know. And that's one thing that was pointed out to me. And I thought, yes, but here's the logic. And I'm not saying, look, I got to convince myself one way or another. Raspberry Pi shape is basically unchanged now for 5 years. Okay. Yeah, the port of USB, whatever. Yeah, the video. Yeah. But it's basically the exact same shape and size. If they don't have it nailed down yet to fit a Raspberry Pi in a case easily, then somebody's doing something dramatically wrong.
So here's what you do. Even if you find a Pi 3 case, you could block up all the holes in your Pi 3 case. You can download whatever, like say you download a Pi 3 case you like, you could block up all the holes, and then you can download the Pi 4 object and use it as a cutter and cut all of the right holes.
I really wish I was better at designing. I will say, if you go to this link in the notes to the Raspberry Pi 4B GPIO Octoprint Ready case, scroll down on the left-hand side. They do have pictures of makes. It does look like there's at least two people who have printed it and taken pictures of it. So there's at least somebody with pictures of it. I'm not going to say, and I'm still not going to say it's the perfect case, but for 3D printing kind of needs, I think this could be acceptable.
Okay, and if you haven't watched the video of Explaining Computers, he ordered an M2 heatsink and cut it with a hacksaw. You could use some sort of powered device.
I he said that, and I'm like, what the hell's wrong with you? I mean, can't you just buy a heatsink? I mean, they're not expensive.
Well, I think cutting up an M2 heatsink I thought was pretty sharp. Searching around on Amazon for M2 heatsinks, they had some M2 heatsinks that had to be like 20 millimeters tall, like as far as fins. I was like, holy cow, that's serious. But yeah, I mean, you know, Dremel angle grinder, you know, you could use a circular. No, well, you need to be very careful because you'd easily lose fingers if you do that wrong. But there's many different ways to cut it. Last thing, I don't even know if I got a hacksaw. At least not in Florida.
I have a really cheap, imitation hacksaw. And don't get me wrong, I commend him on his ingenuity, but I would have just paid, $3 or whatever, $7 and just bought one.
Yeah, I don't, if I recall his numbers, having that big M2 heatsink on the CPU didn't seem to get him any better numbers than I had.
Yeah, I've seen three people doing, posting tests, and I'll say this, all of them, I think, because they've been doing this for years, these are not new devices anymore, these are years old computer, we're in generation 3 of these devices. People now, I think, really do properly understand how to actually push these devices for these kinds of tests, and everybody I saw, I think, did adequate testing on it, recorded everything nicely, pushed the devices pretty hard. Everybody had slightly different methods to the heat sinks and to the fans, and they all got about the same-ish kind of results, which tells me you don't have to be extremely finicky about the heat sink, the size of the heat sink, the type of the heat sink, as long as there's something touching it to pull the heat off, and as long as there's some kind of fan, pulling or pushing air across those heat sinks, you should see decent results.
Yeah, and I was very casual about it myself. Usually, if I'm going to put some adhesive something on, you know, some sticky back something onto something else, I'll clean the surface with alcohol first so I know I get good adhesion. I just stuck these things on. It worked.
Yeah, I wouldn't be extremely, let's just say, detail-oriented or anal about how it's done. It's not complicated. This isn't rocket science. I did find on... I can't remember which site it was now. I want to say it was honestly Manu price, but it wasn't. Very good options on mini PC heat sinks where they literally had like, it was a Merojoid. They literally had like 14 different types of configurations. There's just flat heat sinks. There's heat sinks with all the fins. There's heat sinks with just a couple fins. There was rectangular heat sink, square heat. There was all different types of heat sinks. A Merojoid to me had the most options with as little, you know, browsing and filtering that I've found so far. And I will say again, Amerijoid has never paid any of us a dollar. They haven't done any of us any favors. And I still think they are the preliminary source for me for anything I buy mini PC related, period, bar none, just because of their service and price is fair.
Oh yeah. I called the guy and talked to him. He was nice.
Well, the type of customer service I get tells me they have to be nice, you know?
Yeah, I can't say anything bad about those guys. Good performance, shipping-wise, and absolutely good cost because they're U.S. distributors, so you're not getting it overseas. All that stuff's real good.
Gotcha. Sorry, I'm so blind. Next thing I want to talk about in the notes was actually line 999, and it's partially because I haven't heard anybody else mention this kind of thing anywhere in the past. It's really difficult to find specifications on some of the hardware bits inside of these single board computers. When we go to buy a micro SD card, we always know very upfront what is the speed rating, you know, what's the IO, all the specs, all the numbers we can get all day long. But somebody actually ran a test finally and said it's now basically definitive, kind of like proof. A2 class micro SD cards, which is the highest of the highest class right now, I believe, they do not offer any benefit over the A1 class in a Raspberry Pi.
Okay, in Raspberry Pi. Because I believe I have a 256 gig A2 in a flush mount slot in my MacBook Pro.
Well, on basically any like laptop, I would expect the A2, unless it's like a 6-year-old device, I would expect there to be a definite performance percentage increase that you can measure.
Yeah, my laptop's from 2012, so.
Gotcha. And I will say, I do think there is probably a correlation, because here's the other thing. It's sometimes also hard to find, when you're looking at these single board computers, what is the maximum size of an SD card this thing will support, because there are different standards. Just like there's different Wi-Fi standards, there's different hardware micro SD card standards. And in that standard of size, I do believe also is the standard of speed. So, you know, if you hear something can't take over like 2 terabytes in a micro SD card, it's going to be also probably slower on the higher end cards versus a same type of hardware that can accept a 4 terabyte micro SD card. I don't know. That's pure speculation, but it wouldn't shock me if it is true. So here's the logic. Here's what I'll say first and foremost. A, never, ever, 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 ever buy cheap micro SD cards, because you will suffer because of it. I guarantee you that.
Dude, are you just rubbing my nose in it?
No, because I did it too in the very beginning. I just bought anything. You know, I would buy the sale. You know, it was whatever was on sale. And then I was wondering why, you know, I'm running this, it's running like crap. When I started buying nothing but SanDisk, and I don't have to buy the extreme ones, just the SanDisk Ultras.
Right.
Then I started seeing much better performance.
What I've been doing is I'll go on Amazon and I'll find some SanDisk, either 16 or 32 gigs in a 5-pack, and I'll buy them.
Yeah, and I'm so happy now, because when we were first doing this, it was hard to find a 2-pack. I'm very happy that now you can actually get multi-packs. Here's the thing, and I'm still okay with buying, you know, the A2 class, because here's the logic. honestly, my experience with the quality cards is they almost never die. Yes, of course they're going to die because mm-hmm. that's just.
But they warranty them, and they don't make it a pain in the butt warranty.
Yeah, well, and they just last a really good long time. And here's one of my rules now with everything Linux related, whether it's a laptop, a desktop, a Raspberry Pi, or anything else. The first thing I do is I disable swap. I do not let anything write to my disk unless I'm literally writing to the disk. Swap will age any device you're on, whether it's a spinning disk, an SSD, a micro SD, or anything else. Having swap enabled will considerably age that drive.
Well, how reasonable is it to use swap when you're probably not maxing out the RAM anymore?
Well, to me, 90% of the time now to enable swap isn't because you're maxing out RAM, because like you're saying, you know, even if you have 4 gigs of RAM in Linux, you probably won't ever use 4 gigs of RAM. I can see if you insist on having the ability to hibernate and suspend, then you have to have swap, I believe. My stuff boots up literally in like 6 seconds. Why hibernate? I just shut down.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I literally have not had swap on any device now for a decade. And I'm never going to turn it on again, because I am never going to hibernate or sleep anything again for the rest of my life. I'm just going to power it down and power it up and disable swap everywhere I go, and all my disks will last longer. And if you buy, anytime I talk to anybody and they have any issue with any Pi related thing, the first thing now I ask de facto is what kind of SD card you have. And if they tell me anything yeah. except for what I consider to be the top tier of manufacturers, I tell them throw the card away and buy a new one.
Yep. Yeah, and I just suffered that this past weekend.
Yeah, I mean, it happens to the best of us. So, you know, don't go buy the super cheap SD cards. At the same token, don't feel like you have to buy the most expensive A2 class cards just because there really is almost no performance increase.
But the other thing that goes along with that is back up your SD card. You might want to back it up right after you burned it and did the light configuration. You may want to put a reminder on your calendar, say, hey, back up your micro SD cards on all of your Pi devices. Because I did that on my Observium install, and I was real happy when I looked and I had a backup of it. All I got to do is add the devices back to it. No big deal.
Yeah, and I still haven't found a simple way to say, I want to back up live. Like my Octoprint is running. I don't even want to take my Octoprint down. Can I just, you know, back it up? And I still haven't found a way to do that. And I'll say, because of that, Rich, I made the mistake. I was having issues with prints freezing, like on my bed. And I wasn't sure what the problem was. So I said, let me first do, you know, I used to be a good tech as far as I'm concerned. So my troubleshooting stuff first thing, let's rule out the biggest, most obvious things first. Let me just reflash the Raspberry Pi. And while I'm doing that, let me print directly from the printer without the Raspberry Pi. I printed directly from the printer. No freeze worked fine. Reflashed the Raspberry Pi, printed, everything worked fine, but I didn't back up my SD card. And now for some reason, the exact same camera that worked on the previous installation now won't work.
Oh, crap. So, all right. Can I tell you a similar story?
Yeah.
All right. So on the Pine Rock 64 Pro, I had a PCI card with 4 USB 3 ports. And that ran with, all right, I think Armbian. And then I changed the install to DietPi, and that card didn't run. But it ran when I put the 7-port card in that wouldn't run with Armbian. It just plugged in and ran. I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to try and figure this out. I'm just going to make note of, you know, do an LS mod and see what modules are loaded in case I want to use the other one in the future. But it was cool because I had both cards there, and now I have, you know, 7 extra ports on my Rock Pro 64.
Gotcha. And yeah, that is why I also tell people, you know, don't hesitate. Try different distributions. Yes, they're basically all Debian, but yes, they all are basically tweaked differently and have different prioritization, different drivers, different support. I will say there's at least 2 people now I've heard who basically say that they hate every single board computer because everything is basically just straight Debian. And they hate Debian. I'll say this. I don't really understand how they hate Debian, and I don't want to ask them how they hate Debian. But what my logic is for, you know, all other distributions are company linked, which means they're manipulatable by those companies, period. Debian is the only like large distribution that is still 100% community based. Because of that, I trust the future of Debian.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Debian, and you know, whether you're using Armbian or whatever it may be, you're pretty much the root is Debian, so I don't care.
Yeah, and like what I want on these boards is stability. If I don't have the most cutting edge software, it isn't the end of the world. I want stability. I want to be assured that tomorrow it's going to run as well as it did today, and so forth and so on. So that's the real reason why I'm okay with Debian on these boards. And here's the other plus. If you just load vanilla Debian on a laptop and you don't add any repos, you don't add any sources, you don't add any other external applications, any and everything you can install on that, you can install on anything that runs Debian. If it compiles and is in the default Debian repos, it has to be available for all of its processors that it supports. Among them is the ARM processor. So that to me is the other thing I like about Debian. It makes it much easier to play on different architecture platforms and not have to worry, well, will that work here and not work here? All right, Rich. There really wasn't much more, I'll say, in the world of mini computers. The other thing was on line 998, ARM did quietly, they did basically a big update on their licensing scheme, their schema. And what I'm going to say is if you're a big company who's been doing ARM stuff for years, you're not going to notice anything different, which is the best thing you can do is, you know, not mess with people who are currently using your stuff. So everyone who's currently using ARM has nothing to worry about. All the big companies, the license agreements are going to be basically the same, but they added much more flexibility to the people getting into ARM development. And essentially what it is you can basically download the entire licensing slab of drivers and support and software completely free. You can then pick and choose which part of that you want to use. So if you only need support for this and you only need support for that, you basically can now pick and choose aspects of it out. And then you only have to pay for those parts that you use, which is going to make it much, much, much more affordable for people who are making one-off type ARM products, whether it's a microwave oven or a toaster oven or something like that. It's going to make it much more affordable for them to use officially licensed ARM-supported platforms, which I think is good for ARM in general.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, I don't know if we mentioned last show, Intel basically completely got out of the mobile networking market. Apple then immediately bought their mobile market. Mm. Intel has basically given up on a couple of their platforms, not of course the big ones, but they've given up on a couple platforms, and they've even offloaded some of their production of chips to companies like Samsung.
Yep.
So we're seeing some like quiet, slow, methodical, monumental shifts in big companies like Intel, to where it's really hard for me to see where they're going to land in like 2 or 3 years and how is ARM going to change in 2 or 3 years. The only thing I'm sure of is for the next at least 2 or 3 years, we as consumers are going to have much more power available to us. Developers are going to have much better infrastructure environments to develop on, and the prices seem to be just continuously going down. For at least the short term. So I'm really hopeful.
I have a buddy from New York who actually moved down to Florida, and I didn't know it until I was up in New York and saw him again. And he lives like 20 miles from me. And he does a very specific job in ICs, and he's known in the industry. So when you have something and you have a problem, you call him. And he was working for Intel for a number of years as an employee. He used to do consulting. And Intel basically shut down the factory he was working at.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Intel has to do what's right by the shareholders, which unfortunately means they don't always do right by the employees. I've known now, I think, three people who work for Intel. Then stuff like Clear Linux, I'll say, is definitely getting more attention than I think everyone thought it was going to get within the company in the last 2 years. They're coming out with a dedicated graphics card, discrete graphics card. So I don't know who really knows where Intel's going to be in like 2 or 3 years from now, but I expect them to be just as important and just as rich as they are now. It's just they might be doing different things.
Now, Intel sold, I believe it was the modem manufacturing off to Apple.
Well, actually, they first said we quit, we're never doing it again, and they were on the precipice of firing everybody in that part doing that. And then, like less than 2 days later, Apple scooped in and basically saved all the employees' jobs and bought the entire unit.
Wow.
But here's the thing: they bought the entire unit, but they didn't. They invested in the unit, and they're going to let it still do its own thing. They're still going to let it develop and sell to other people. But it's obvious that, you know, they're going to be there to help Apple's ARM infrastructure just become a little bit more self-responsive and allow their own modems to be made by like almost in-house people.
Well, the other thing, so what I don't like about that, because it kind of smells like this, I'm not saying it is, it just smells like this, is some corporations buy another corporation just for the intellectual property, and then they'll sell the company later. Like, you know, Unix got sold around. AT&T owned it, they sold it, and you know, it got handed around a bit. What if I recall correctly, Lamborghini was owned by Chrysler for a little while. Now it's owned by Volkswagen.
Yeah, I didn't hear anything, now that you say that, I didn't hear anything about any of the intellectual property, if it stayed with Intel or not.
Without the IP, the company's nothing. So I can't picture Intel would have held on to the IP.
Well, I can picture an arrangement where Apple will have complete access to it. But the question
Could
is
be.
can Intel still profit from it, kind of thing? But they made it clear that their goal was to get the talent. They wanted the people who knew how to do this stuff to be available to do Apple modems. And just months earlier, they said they didn't expect iPhones to have 5G capabilities until, I want to say, 2021. But then, since the purchase of the Intel stuff, they do believe 2020. There'll be quote unquote 5G ready phones, which I'll say this, most of the United States won't be ready, actually ready for full time 5G probably until like 2022 anyway. So I really don't understand the rush, unless, of course, you just want to have a checkbox on the side of your box to say that you're 5G compatible.
Well, the other thing, I saw a story recently that 5G devices are, you know, sucking down the battery pretty healthy.
Well, yeah.
So,
Yeah, I mean, don't you remember the very first 4G LTE Android device was the Droid 2 or the Droid Max, where literally when you were on nothing but LTE, the battery would last 3.5 hours.
you know what? I do remember my early devices, because I did have the Droid Bionic and whatever the first Droid was. And I don't know if it was 3G and I wish I could set it to only use 2G, or if it was 4G and I wanted to use only 3G because of the power consumption.
Right, yeah. I mean, early on, the battery usage is always bad, and it always just, you know, gets better over time. The question is how long. Yeah, I mean, it's going to take time for everything to get ironed out and smoothed out.
But what I find interesting about Intel, and Intel really, we barely talk about Intel on this show. There are a few Intel single board computers that we have spoken about. The interesting thing is Intel faces competition from AMD. It faces competition, not that it's in the same lane, but it's parallel from ARM. And also Intel does graphics, so they're facing, you know, competition from all of the graphics manufacturers. So I don't know if they're pulling back to concentrate on the core of what they're doing, their core, x86, if that's their strategy.
Well, yeah, I'll say they have more competition, I think, than anybody else because they're I don't want to say spread thin. They're in so many arenas. And in the ARM world, it's basically just market share. The more ARM processors that are sold by other companies, then there's the potential for less x86 processors to be sold. It isn't a zero-sum game exactly, but the more phones and the more tablets people have running ARMs, then I do believe there's a less need for desktop and laptops running x86.
Oh, and the other x86 thing that I want to loop in, not that Apple, I forget what percentage of laptops, desktops are Apple, but they're moving off the x86 platform. So they're not going to be buying from Intel anymore.
Yeah, and I mean, even if it's, 10% or whatever, it isn't the number I think that's going to hurt Intel. It's going to be like the ego that's going to hurt them more. And I'll say this, no doubt, if Apple puts out a ARM laptop running their operating system, A, you'll probably see just as good, if not better performance, but B, you'll probably see like twice the battery life.
Well, also, look, the licensing is a lot there. If that's going to occur, if Apple's going full ARM on their laptops or fill in the blank, it's going to be a lot more difficult for Intel to justify how it charges for its CPUs, and they may need to go to some sort of ARM-like licensing agreement.
I don't know, but I know it's just going to be a constantly changing thing. Mac, Apple finally saw every single one of their hardware categories saw a significant decrease in the last reimporting cycle. Going back, I want to say, was it almost 16 reporting cycles, 4 years? Everything is down in sale numbers, and they basically for the last year have been telling investors, look, we are transitioning to services. And because they first saw less laptops being sold, less minis being sold, less iPads being sold, and less phones being sold, sooner or later, partially because the more you charge for these items, the more people feel like I have to make it last, which just means
Oh,
people
for
are going to
sure.
refresh their devices less often. So it was bound to happen. As a company, I think they've honestly prepped themselves pretty good for this. So when they do refresh the hardware, I think it's then going to give people another reason to reinvest.
Well, I was just talking about I'm really finding it difficult to consider buying another $1,000 phone. I nearly have no interest in that.
You ain't the only one. Samsung
And
also just reported huge, huge drops in sale numbers, except for the lowest of the lowest Samsung Galaxy S10 model, the A version. Google reported they sold, I want to say it was three times more Pixel 3a than the Pixel 3, which is the cheaper version of the phone. Huawei reported, because they're not the $1,000 phone manufacturer, most of their phones are around $400 to $600. They reported their largest sales numbers in the history of their company this last quarter, even with all the US embargo threats that are happening. So I think the idea of a $1,000 phone was very short-lived, and it's basically coming to an end.
yeah, I think it was more of an ego stroking, and even for myself to have the, newest phone, the most expensive Samsung phone. I'll be absolutely okay with a $400 phone next time around.
Well, and I do believe at there was a point in time where you if you didn't spend that amount of money, you literally were not getting a device that was as good. Where now you can literally spend between $400 to $500, put it side by side with a $1,000 phone, and it's very difficult to tell the difference in performance, in quality, in screen, and everything else. So I'm happy for it to end. I'm not still convinced it's going to end, but I think it could be ending right in front of our eyes.
So one last, not quite mini PC thing I want to ask you about. It'll dovetail into this. So we're talking devices, and we all originally had desktops. So monitor, CPU case, keyboard, mouse. Then we got laptops. Then we got netbooks. Then we got tablets, and then we got Chromebooks. So I'm not sure what the next, you know, skirt size will be, or tech fashion will be. But I've been rocking a $200 and change Chromebook for like 2 years. I got it like at the year-end blowout at Costco. So it's a 14-inch Acer, and I've been super happy. My only two quips were no backlit keyboard and no touchscreen. I did get for my wife a 15-inch Acer refurb on Amazon for $200. She got it yesterday, so I haven't seen it because I won't be home till tomorrow night. It's got a backlit keyboard and a touchscreen, so I'm kind of excited to check it out and maybe get myself a $200 Chromebook.
Yeah, Chromebooks to me are the best thing about the Chromebook is that it really is the number one selling laptop on Amazon during holidays and sales for now, I want to say almost 3 years. They've driven consumer expectation per dollar up to where now you don't have to spend $600-$800 and still get a good amount of functionality. The thing is, you know, all the functionality that's came to the browser has enabled it. And I'll say this, the $200 to $300 Chromebook market, it literally is insane, because if you were to just wipe it, put an SSD in, install a full operating system, it would be a $400 to $600 laptop.
Right. And so I think you're insane if you pay more than $300 for a Chromebook. I think you're really, you know, out to lunch. Chatter on the Wire in the YouTube chat has a couple of good points here. You know, back in the day, back in the 80s, you were paying, what did you pay for a desktop computer?
Oh, back then it was around $1,008 to $2,000.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, anybody was paying $2,000 for a computer. Now, okay, my MacBook Pro that I have here from 2012, October 2012, was, I don't know if it was $2,400 when I got it. And I will continue to drive this thing. The battery's shot. I'm not replacing it. But that's why I got a Chromebook. My Chromebook's good for 8 freaking hours. And if I need to use my Mac to edit a video, I'll plug it in. But so $2,000 in the 80s, what was a good income in the 80s? I mean, if you were making 50, 60 grand, was that a good income?
You were rich back then, yeah.
So $2,000, let's just say $2,000 for a laptop. That was crazy money. That was, I don't know, was it a good used car? What was it?
It was at least a modest used car. You know what I mean? It was at least a decent used car. And I'll say this, both our expectations of what we can do with these devices has skyrocketed exponentially versus what it was back then. And the prices came down, which to me is just proof of, you know, the free market and, you know, Moore's Law and everything just fitting in nicely to our world kind of thing. I am really honestly happy that I can spend less than $300 on a phone. And I literally can do everything I need to do on it. I can listen to 20 plus hours of spoken word podcast at 4 to 5x speed, and it doesn't choke. It doesn't go crazy. I can browse the internet, you know, for hours without little issue. Or I can literally pop open a now 3-year-old Chromebook Flip, and the battery still lasts for 14 hours kind of thing. I'm really happy with our tech choices today because of the advancement of mini PCs. I really do look forward to our choices here in 2 years.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And Chatter on the Wire says 35K was good in our area in the late 80s. I'm not sure where his area was. Late 80s. I guess I was doing my first jobs and still living at home. So
yeah, back then I want to say, if you were getting paid in the Baltimore area, 40 to 45, you were living pretty large. Now, of course, there were people, you know, in the city working at insurance companies getting paid $85,000+ a year. But in the burbs, if you could pull 40s off, you were living really nice.
Yeah, I'd hate to tell you what my dad retired earning. And unfortunately, the income and investments my dad, let's see. All right. Basically, we had a single income household, and without adjusting dollars, just saying dollars to dollars from when he retired to what my wife and I make, we're probably making 5 to 6 times what my dad made, but we're broke.
Well, partially, okay, tangent. Partially, you got to remember, Rich, back then you had to almost try to spend money. Most of the activities.
Oh, yeah, we had heat and electric, and that was it.
And the electric you used was tenfold less, and your activities were not watching all this streaming content. It wasn't really going to the movies as frequently. It wasn't. It was literally doing It was doing activities that didn't cost money, where now every company's objective is to literally squeeze a penny out of you to do anything that you can do. If you literally take a look at just percentage of income versus daily expenditures, you'll see we're probably spending 3 to 4 times the amount of money as they were back then. But the thing is, we're no more entertained than they were back then. We just had, you know, different standards.
Yeah, realistically, you went to the library, you could rent a VHS movie. You know, you could get a book and read it. You could sit there. I haven't been to a library in more than 10 years. I couldn't tell you what one looked like.
And you can still go to a library and you can get DVDs, you can get audiobooks. But also back then we had lawn darts to like keep us company.
Yeah. I know. I was watching Fox News and Greg Gutfeld was talking about lawn darts. I haven't seen them in a long time.
There's a reason why. And I'll say this. Two more quick side tangents, because I got you on the line, quote unquote. I did watch the first season of, was it Battlefield Earth?
Oh, you're talking about that Gene Roddenberry? Yeah. Is it Battlefield Earth? Why is that not ringing in my head right? Earth Final Conflict.
I watched the first season of that. Unbelievably cheesy, but good. First season, really good. End of the first season, obviously a contract dispute, killed the main character off. Watched the first 5 episodes of season 2. Can't watch anymore. It's bad. Can't watch it.
Ugh.
But yes, I do see what you meant, how they had the foldable screen on the phone. It really wasn't foldable. It was rollable. Supposedly, I would say it was Sony or Samsung, in a private thing with no tech journalists allowed, they did unveil a rollable phone. So the only question is, how long do we have that? The other tangent is, we talked about, okay, I have that downloaded because that's how I do things. And I have it on my Plex server because that's how I do things. I'm worried, genuinely worried about the future of Plex. I listen to a lot of stuff, and I don't like the fact that I'm hearing Plex being spoken on non-tech related content. The more eyeballs that are on Plex, the more likely we're going to have some sort of government intrusion, some legal intrusion,
like,
to where they literally insist that they send queries of what people have to copyright holders. Because if we lose Plex, there is a system, I want to say it's called Streamify, where we can basically host our own service that does not connect to a cloud service, and we can grant access to other people, but they have to know our actual internet addressable link to access it. So here in the next year,
or I don't know if you hit the wrong button, I don't hear you anymore.
In the next year, I'll just say there's a chance we're going to see the beginning of the death of Plex, and if that happens, I'm going to be very sad. You should be able to hear me now.
Yeah, I heard the last couple of words you said.
Yeah, it's just I'm hearing Plex mentioned in places where I never expected it to be mentioned, and I worry about its popularity becoming too popular for its own good.
Yeah, you dropped out in that conversation. Yeah, that's kind of scary, because I remember Napster, nobody knew what it was except us geeks. And and then everybody came down on it.
Yeah. Chatter's right in chat. Battlefield Earth was the L. Ron Hubbard, John Travolta movie with the guy with the lazy eye. I always get that backwards for some reason. I get that name confused easily. The Gene Roddenberry one, there were parts of it, I'm going to say, that were genius. But watching it in succession, how I can, you know what I mean? Watch, because I watch it at 2x, because that's how I watch everything. So I can zip through, you know, 16 hours of content pretty quickly. And I notice how from show to show, people's makeup changes and how they try to change how the people look. The first three episodes of the show, the lead actress, they changed her look dramatically. And then season two, they completely changed her look even more to where I just, you know, couldn't take her seriously anymore.
Yeah, that's kind of funny. I started watching it again when you gave me the links on YouTube for it, and I kind of fell off that wagon.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's one of those things, all good things must come to an end, you know, just like the mini PC show.
Indeed.
So do you have any last parting words you want to talk about there, Rich?
Yeah, just if you go to flyingrich.com, you can check out my social media stuff, subscribe to my YouTube channel. You can check out my heat test on the Raspberry Pi 4. And so for, you know, $10-$12, you can satisfy and quell the temperature demons on your Raspberry Pi 4.
Gotcha. I'll say we haven't done an episode of the makers, I want to say, for nearly 2 months. We're going to have another episode coming out, and if you're watching the video stream, what you'll see is the latest print that I did.
Woo!
And I'm fairly impressed with it. This bottom part basically can twist off, and it's basically a lightsaber.
Oh, no way!
Yeah,
very
and
cool.
It's like 3.5 feet long, basically, fully extended. I did have to tweak a lot of settings onto it, but total cost of it, I want to say in materials, was like $180.
Is that nuts? Is that so? It's $180. It's some of your ingenuity, and it's probably about 40 hours worth of print time.
No,
right?
Well, here's the thing: I changed my slicer from Cura to Prusa slicer. My print time on like one of these, because I printed each of these parts of the saber out individually, that went from 4.5 hours down to 1 hour. So the total print time was 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, about 10 hours.
Wow. Oh, I got to check that. I haven't had my printer running in a long time, but I got to fire it up. I got to do a couple of things.
Well, when I do the show, the link will be in the notes. The guy has done not only lightsabers, but he's done also pirate swords, daggers, where the entire blade is in the hilt of the handle. So it's basically collapsible, kind of same exact methodology, just differently styled. The maturity in the designs that are out there, in my opinion, in the last year has literally kind of went insane. The printers are, you know, better, but they're not dramatically better. They're just better. But the quality of designs that are in the free world to me has just gotten insane.
So the handle, was that printed as two halves, or how many pieces was that handle?
Yeah, they had two versions of it. One, it's all printed simultaneously, everything in one shot. Or you can print the hilt, the cap, and then different color blades with basically three different print jobs if you want.
Very cool. The threads look really nice, too.
I am literally like blown away at how I can print these kinds of things and not have to worry about a job failing and have it, you know, just because it's of the weird angles, the threads come out remarkably well, is what I'll say. I'm really going to try to record an episode of that here Friday night. We'll see how that turns out. Okay, I want to definitely thank you for coming out. I really hope that Brian doesn't work too hard, and I hope we get to talk to him next week. I want to thank everyone again for their support. I want to thank everyone for coming out. Do not forget, if you want to send us an email, you can very easily send us an email at minipc@podnuts.com. I got to keep reminding myself to check with you guys. If you guys are automatically forwarded emails when it's sent there, because we definitely had at least a couple emails come in. We got to get a little bit better at organizing them for the show. One email really quick. Tony from SMLR, Sunday Morning Linux Review, Tony Bemis, one of the definitely smarter domain network admins, infrastructure admins I think I've met in my life, I can say. Really quick. Email from Tony. Hey guys, this is Tony. I want to say how I'm loving the show. I have a comment about the Witty Pi 3 real-time clock and power management for the Raspberry Pi. You guys talked about it in show 94. I have a use that I would use it for, and that's when the Pi is not going to be connected to the internet much. This was voice dictation, and it says the use, Y-O-U-T-H-S, but it wasn't that. It was the use, U-S-E. The use, I'm looking at this Rode Apple Pi, Raspberry Pi Forums view topic. It's basically a dash cam kind of thing. It's to turn a Raspberry Pi into a dash cam that integrates stats from the car. So the Raspberry Pi being in the car, it needs to be shut down properly, and it's also... when it turns on, it might not have access to the internet.
Right.
And that's the key. If you are not 100% positive it's going to be connected to the internet at boot, and you need to have time, you need to have accurate time, then you almost have to have something like this. So there you go. Tony, thank you very much for the email. There were more emails, but his was the one that I remembered off the top of my head. So again, thank you, Tony, and we will talk to everyone again real soon.
This is Martin from Podnuts Pro. Thank you so much for choosing this podcast to be in your ears right now. Don't forget to support all the other Podnuts shows on the Podnuts Network. And we cannot do this without you. So please, if you have any questions, comments, concerns, email us at podnutspro@podnuts.com.